This is the beginning of Class 4.
Sasi Bhagi Jushin Eta Shan Viravin Shinyan Dekyan Padi Sangye Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogunanda Shingla
thing to talk about this week is what happens when you do that. You know, what are the karmic results? What kind of consequences do you get from different kinds of karma? And there are many, many different presentations in the Abhidharma. I gave you 20-something pages. That's only a small group of them. All right? There's many more. But here are the most basic three. Here is according to when it's going to ripen on you. When are you going to experience it? So this is a vision by when are you going to experience that karma. So here is according to when it's going to ripen on you. When are you going to experience it? So this is a vision by when are you going to experience that karma. So the first one is Tongyokile. Say
Tongyokile.
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 What's Tong mean? You know Tong, I'm like this. Now that's Tong. Tong means to see. Like Tong means not to see. So Tong means karma. And Tong means which you are going to see. Karma which you are going to see. And that refers to karma that you see the result in this same life that you committed. So the first division of karma by when you experience it, the result, is called karma which you see. And that means karma where you see the result in this life, before you die. And we mentioned before that that's the basis of the secret teachings. And it's also, it would have to be some kind of very powerful karma. And I'll explain that more later tonight. You know, what kinds of karma is it that are so powerful that you're going to see the result before you take your next breath? The second one is kene. Say kene.
Kene.
Nyongyurki.
Nyongyurki.
Le.
Le.
I was out really late last night. Someone was mad moving about that. Okay. Kene means after born, after you are born. And Nyongyurki Le means experienced after you are born.
And Gyur means what?
Which will be. Nyong means experience. And Le means karma. You don't have to worry about it because you're not the Tibetan class. But if you're interested, karma which will be experienced after you're born. It's completely backwards from English syntax. That doesn't just mean after you're born. It means in your next life. And it means technically your second next life. Why? You have to take a bardo birth between them. A bardo is a separate birth, really. But it means in your next rebirth.
You're saying the bardo and then the form rebirth?
Yeah. The next birth you take after your the bardo connected to this life. But actually a bardo is a kind of birth also. Don't get confused about it. So the second kind of karma is karma that you experience in the very next life. Actually a bardo is a kind of birth also. Don't get confused about it. So the second kind of karma is karma that you experience in the very next life after this one. Lendang Shenla, say Lendang.
Lendang
Shenla.
Shenla.
Nyonggyur.
Nyonggyur.
Kile.
Kile.
Lendang.
Lendang
Shenla.
Shenla.
Nyonggyur ki.
Nyonggyur ki.
Le. Lendang means time, like in two times, three times, four times. Shen means other. La means in another. Nyonggyur ki le means karma which will be experienced. Nyong means experience. Here means will be. He here means which will. And lay means karma. So that's karma that will be experienced in another at another time. Which means what?
Anytime after your next life.
Anytime after the immediate next life. So it could be the second life onto, you know, a million later. Okay? That's Lenda Shema Nyongi Rime. What determines when it takes place? There's a couple of things. We'll talk about it later today, and also you have to study the Abhidharma presentation on the Wheel of Life. That's another story. They discuss how many births it takes to work out a whole Wheel of Life, one wheel. It's more than one birth taking place in that wheel.
So if you were to achieve Buddhahood in this, for the very next life, the number two would get wiped out?
Yeah. Well, it can't be activated.
Mm-hmm.
It's inert. It'll never do anything. It's like they say, it's like a seed that's rotten. It'll never produce a result. You know, whether you actually get rid of it or it disappears is a moot point, because it'll never do anything. It has no function.
But Michael, the point is that when you achieve Buddhahood, it's not because you've eliminated all your bad karmic seeds altogether. It's just that there's so many of them, what's left become inert.
I'm not sure what the... I believe that's true, but I don't, they don't emphasize that in the scriptures. You know what I mean? I guess logically it would have to be that way, or maybe you have some kind of... The word karma in Buddhism almost always means like dirty karma. I mean, there is a thing called pure karma, but it refers to dirty karma of higher beings, like Arhat. So the things that Buddhas experience, you know, when Buddhas experience a pure field, you know, when Buddhas experience a paradise as a result of their actions in this life, they don't often call it karma. It's not given the word karma. It's not presented in the presentations on karma. Karma almost always has to do with samsara. You know, the word karma. When a Buddha does good deeds and for trillions of years, and then as a result of that, he achieves a Buddha field. They don't really call it karma that often. It's just called the result of his deeds. So that's just, you only know that by reading a lot of scriptures, and you notice that after a while they're not talking about the Buddha in terms of karma. So karma has this connotation of ignorant karma. That, you know, good or bad, it's going to lead you to more of this kind of fluctuating results, where even the good things you get wear out. So those are the three basic divisions of the first way. Blessed Buddha is going to divide it in many, many different ways.
What is the it you're referring to?
Excuse me?
What is karma. The it you're referring to? He's going to divide it.
Oh, karma. Millions of ways. I mean, the whole fourth chapter of the Abhidharma is long. And I'm not going to give you all of them. It's too many. We'll touch on the most important ones. The Abhidharma gives another division of, there's four kinds of karma which must ripen, which will definitely ripen. And I thought that would be useful for you.
Won't they all ripen?
No. Not according to the Abhidharma. There's a very famous Abhidharma is sort of wimpy on this point. I mean, The Vinaya is very clear about it. The Buddha, over and over in the Vinaya, he repeats this verse that is later repeated by Chandrakirti, Nagarjuna, Parahika, many Avalokiteshvara, many different. The one especially that the Buddha is a famous Leni Kapagyayam Chumisa. It will never go away. Karma can never just disappear. Impossible. Now, whether a karma will definitely produce its results or not, or how certain is it that it will be activated, or that it's fixed, the Abhidharma talks about karmas which are certain and karmas which are not certain. Sometimes they say that Abhidharma is a little bit different. But anyway, you can take these as karma, things that make karma very certain to give you a result. There's certain things, like if you kill someone unintentionally or something, that's a little bit weaker. But these are four that must ripen into a future experience. They must be experienced as one of those three that we just talked about. They say that if these four elements are present, the likelihood that the karma is going to come back to you is very certain. Generally, any karma you do is going to come back to you. But these are like more. You'll see.
Oh, those are those four. I
think. Well, we'll go through them. Shubh Jakpo means Shubh means power, force. Jakpo means fierce, like the tantric deities who are fierce, like are called Jakpo. And Shubh Jakpo means that the emotion is very strong. Like if you commit a karma with fierce anger, or else you commit a virtue with fierce faith, feelings of faith. You know, you've had them in your life, you know, when you almost cry, and that's like some kind of very fierce emotion that you have. Okay, that's the first element that would make a karma very certain to produce a future result for you.
Powerful emotion?
Yeah, if it's related with a powerful emotion, fierce emotion.
Good or bad.
Either good or bad, yes. It can be love for a lama, it can be fierce anger or fierce jealousy, or, you know, those are negative ones.
I lost the reference. Is it indeed accomplished with a fierce emotion?
Yeah, which is related, no, not the emotion itself, which is related to that emotion.
So what we would refer to as a crime of passion would
is even worse
than a cold calculating.
I don't know. Greed can be pretty passionate and be cold and calculating too, you know.
Well, I mean, like a Nazi killing, which is totally a very clinical state, like an affair, as opposed to someone who, out of a jealous rage, killed someone close to
I think you could almost say that, except that the Nazi would probably be a fierce ignorance.
Or an underlying
hatred. To be able to do that over and over again with a cold calculating, it's like a fierce kind of ignorance. It's very. To be cold about it and to be, you know, detached about it is a very strong emotion of ignorance. You see, I mean, mental function, you could say. That person doesn't have any shame, he's not embarrassed, he thinks it's a normal thing to do to kill people. And I'd say that was an overwhelming ignorance, which is also would be in here.
So you're using emotion in the term of thought also?
Yeah. The two examples given in the scripture are anger and faith. So they have to be emotions, but they do later, they describe, there's a whole, the Abhidharma is very dry, and I mean, you may have got some feeling of it now, but a lot of people can't stand the Abhidharma, but if you really appreciate it, I mean, it gives you the information you need. It's an encyclopedia of the brain and of the spirit, you know, it's very good. So they discuss the possibilities between, like, can you commit adultery out of hatred. You say, yeah, you know, you want to hurt the spouse, so you go with the person's spouse because you hate the person. You don't have any desire for the spouse, you just want to hurt the person.
That always comes back to an emotion. Thinking, for example, you know.
No, and then they say ignorance, like, you know, the way animals kill animals.
For example, if someone says, you know I'm right, and I'm sure I'm right. And they do something. Would that fall in the category?
If it's a, yeah, that's what we were talking
strong
about.
Feeling.
It's not being said, right. It's just right to kill these people. You know, it's morally right. And we have to clean up the country. That's just, they talk about Nyomo Shichewa, they talk about Maripa Shichewa. Maripa Shichewa means that person's mind, as he commits that bad karma, is controlled by ignorance. And that's as bad as anger. It's on the level, it's worse. So So it would qualify as number one. Ignorance, just pure stupidity.
Well, any inaccurate thought then would qualify as number one. Any charged up inaccurate thought.
It's a long story. I mean, there's this thing about identification of the object. If you think it's your enemy in a dark alley and you shoot him and then it turns out not to be your enemy, it's a little bit less. That's another story. Okay, so, yundengishi.
Yundengishi.
Yunden means what? You know, yunden means good quality, good personal quality, and shi means basis or object. And here it refers to the three ratnas. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. You guys know what they are technically. You know, Buddha is easy, enlightened being. Dharma is not the teachings. The teachings are called Dharma, but they're not the real Dharma. The real Dharma is cessations and those paths. That's the real Dharma. And the real Sangha is people who have seen emptiness directly, whether they have robes or not. In this school, selflessness is described in the second chapter. What makes you an Arya? What makes you a Sangha? And when they go for refuge, it's a little bit different from the higher school. So yunengishi means some extraordinary virtuous object. And it means the three ratnas. You do something against them or you do something for them. You know, like there were people in India who tried to harm the Buddha. And that was some kind of extraordinary. That kind of karma is certain to produce a result.
So how does that work? I've never understood how that works. It makes no logical sense to me. But just by virtue of walking around a holy object, you get to create
karma. We'll get to it. We're going to discuss it tonight, actually. We'll get there. Basically, it's this. And that's why it's so bad to commit suicide, for example. The human body, anything that's close to producing enlightenment in people is so rare. The word three gems means koin chok, it means rare. And it's so rare that someone gets close to understanding everything they need to know to get out of this suffering, that anything you do, those objects are it's like destroying the last AIDS medicine in the world. It's a horrible crime against humanity to commit suicide if you already know some Dharma.
I understand that, but I don't understand how that equates to walking by it being one something.
It's just to be in the environment, in the environment of a very holy object.
There's no motivation, there's no intention, there's none of the four components.
There's Munshi, which is the thing is actually very holy, you know. And so there's this famous story of the fly, right?
It doesn't make sense to me.
It's there. It's a very famous, it's in the Abhidharma also. That story is given in the Abhidharma. Or similar story.
Does it still apply, Michael, if it's not quite such a high thing? I mean, you know, being around...
Yeah, right. There's this order, there's this pecking order, you know, Buddha, and then they say Arhat, and then they say Ayas, and then they say Ma, and then, you know, Lama, and stuff like that, all those things. Yindengishi.
What kind of things do you do against these people? I mean, just three things. Anything? Bad words?
Yeah. Did you do anything physical?
So it could be physical or verbal?
Yeah. And mental, too.
Mental, too?
Yeah. Yeah, that's all a bunch of malarkey. Yeah.
How is that different than being skeptical?
A skeptical is required of a good Buddhist. The Buddha said, you know, take my words like gold, file them, cut them, burn them. It's a famous quotation. And it's the way you should be towards anyone who seems to be bad in the whole world. You should say, I don't really know. They could be a bodhisattva trying to teach us something. But, you know, I have to resist what this person appears to be to me. And also, I don't believe in this person right now. I mean, it looks like a bad deed to me. But you don't hate them, or you don't, you know what I mean?
You don't judge,
but you judge insofar as you do what you know to be right. But you don't decide in your mind that this is a bad person, because you can't read their mind.
You're saying you discriminate, but you don't make a moral judgment?
I don't know, you don't hate them. Hatred will cause you problems. You say, this is wrong, this has to be resisted. you know, but you don't hate the person. And you don't decide, in Tibetan it's called tak chepa, you don't finalize in your mind that this person is evil, or you can't be sure. What he's doing is evil, and you must resist it. What are his real motivations? You know, maybe he's setting things up, maybe he can see the future, he has to be in this place to shoot Hitler or something. You know, you don't know. You just don't know. He could be pretending to be bad. You don't know. You release judgment on him, but you, on his actions, you say, this is a bad action, I have to resist it. Insofar as my knowledge, insofar as my vows, I have to resist this person. That's okay. You must check the Dharma. You must check things. The Buddha required it. Otherwise, you won't be a good Buddhist, because then the next thing that comes that sounds good, you'll follow that. You'll change easily. Well, malarkey is like, you say it sounds like malarkey to me. I don't, you know, let me investigate it further. That's okay. But it is malarkey. That's different. We've said before in these classes, ultimately, according to Tsongkhapa, you will see that every single line in Buddhist scripture makes sense, and that it all ties together, and that there's no contradiction in all those tens of thousands of books, maybe 300,000 books that are there. There's no contradictions at all. But that takes a long time to do. It takes a deep understanding of it before you reach that. And in the meantime, you have to suspend judgment. You see what I mean? It's better. It's healthier. Say, it doesn't make sense to me. That argument sounds a little silly. You know, it's in the scripture. I'll leave it for now. You know, that's much.
But don't you have to judge, like when you're looking for a teacher, there's different steps in judging a good teacher, a bad teacher, and following a good teacher, who follows, you know, you have to judge.
We talked about the 10 qualities in the first class, the very first class, I think it was one of the first classes. 10 qualities of a good teacher. And yeah, you must judge that.
So then how do you do this?
You take those list of 10 things which the Buddha spoke, and then which actually Maitreya spoke, and then you apply them to the best of your ability at that point. And that's, you have to do that.
So don't you think this is a contradiction? Because you just said you shouldn't judge, but yet you have to judge.
You can't say, there's been Buddhist teachers who drank alcohol. You know, and you say, this guy is an alcoholic, he's definitely a bad person, he definitely wants to drink alcohol for the effect. Or is he doing it for some other reason? We don't know. You can't know. Just leave it alone. Leave it alone.
So what do you do?
You
follow someone who...
You don't follow a teacher who drinks. But you don't judge the teacher. You know, you can't. You can't. Like any other person, you can't judge him. But if you're going to follow the scriptures, you can't follow a person who drinks. That's all.
So the Buddha, when he killed all those people, and somebody would have seen it, he wouldn't have followed him. Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. And he wasn't a Buddha at that time. He was a Bodhisattva. Okay. Anyway, Rinchaktu. It's a difficult question. But basically, follow those 10 rules. Look for a teacher who has the 10 qualities. They're plain, old, normal virtues called. You know, maybe someday we'll get up to the level where, you know, a teacher can be wild or crazy and real. Be able to learn from that. But in the meantime, everybody wants to be the special half percent, you know. It's not necessary. Dalai Lama is very good. You know, nice, normal, holy person. Jinchaku. Jinchaku means over and over again. What do you say? On a continual basis. This means that any bad deed that you have, you're addicted to, and that you keep doing over and over again, the power of that will be, it'll get stronger, and then that will be certain to produce it. I mean, technically, which we'll learn later, anything you do produces a result. But there's a lot of special cases. And in Mahayana, of course, there's the purification methods by which you can remove the effect of the karma if it's done properly. And done properly implies that you don't do it again. That's not easy. Yeah. Or that you control yourself very well in the future. Yeah. Even if it's not perfect. This is like if you can't stop looking at girls your whole life. You know, every time you see a cute girl, you know you're not supposed to. And you do.
Even if you're not a monk?
Even if you're not. I was brought up that way. My father said, check this one out. Yeah, okay. And it's been hard for me to break my whole life. So, I mean, that's Kim Chakshu. If I keep doing it over and over again, the effect will be more powerful, and it will be certain to produce results. So, some people are compulsive liars. Some people, you know, they have... Anybody who's in this plane, which is called the desire realm, if you got here and you're not a Patrick Grady or something... You have one. At least one. It's different. Each person is different. But whatever we had took us all to the same level. We're all on the same level. If you're just a normal person, then you have something. You have something to overcome. You know, something. You have some yin chakra problem. Or you wouldn't be here. When you see emptiness directly, you'll realize about the other realms, and you'll realize that everyone in this realm has some common denominator that put us in this realm, and you still have that problem. And everyone has their own. Say, Pama.
Pama.
Sopa.
Sopa.
Pama.
Pama.
Sopa.
Sopa.
When I took my first week of Tibetan in Dharamsala 20 years ago, and I wanted to get into the advance course, and Shepa Rinpoche is a great lama. He wanted me to be in the course, but I had to pass an oral exam. You know, what's the Tibetan word for this and this and this? And this? I have no idea. You know, even, how do you say Papa and Mama? I said Pama. Right. You're in the class. So Pama means mother and mother. Right. Sapa means to kill. And the line in the Abhidhamma Kosha says, even if it's with a virtuous intent, even if it's like you think you're putting them out of their misery or something, like euthanasia, it is murder of your father and mother. And I was close to that. You know, my mother, she was dying, and you know, there were big discussions in the family. You know, should she undergo these treatments and keep her alive for another week, or should we just forego it? And you know, according to the Abhidhamma and according to Buddhism in general, you must keep them alive as long as you can.
Are you saying if the motivation is to benefit them, it's still there?
Yeah, even if you think, that's what the Abhidhamma specifically says in this line. And you can read it in your reading. There's the Abhidhamma, that's about to take the time to say, even if you think you're putting them out of pain or something like that, it's one of the worst deeds you can do. So you have to be very careful. Yeah.
Is that all in a situation like where we have modern technology that is unnaturally, it enables us to continue a life beyond the point where it was normal?
Rinpoche has said yes.
That's part of
the he said to turn off his murder. He has said that. He's also said he never want to be connected. I think,
you just don't need
to. I just wouldn't fool around with it. It's karmically too dangerous. I wouldn't even... my argument is always something quite different, which is that if all of us are going to go to hell after this, you're not helping them. I mean, to think that you're taking them out of pain why do you think that? Do you think they're going to disappear? Do you think their mind is going to stop? You know, don't you think they're going to go somewhere the next minute afterwards? And is that place better than the pain they're in now? I mean, the odds, according to all Buddhist scriptures, are infinitely against it. You know, so it's a kind of ignorance to me. You're not putting them out of any pain. They're probably going to experience much worse pain shortly afterwards.
But sometimes the longing of a person's life suggests them to more suffering.
Mm-hmm. Tiny suffering compared to where most of us can go after. I mean, the suffering of all the other realms is infinitely worse than the worst suffering in this realm, according to scripture.
So according to this, if you have the means to sustain a person's life, you should do
it. So if a person decides not to, let's say, says, my wishes are that I don't want to be connected to the machine, then you have to sort of abide to those wishes. is that person considered like committing suicide in a way?
I don't know. I guess by extension you could say that. I haven't heard anyone discuss that.
No, there's people who do.
I know that people do that. No, I've had people. My stepmother told me she wouldn't want to be. She asked me to sign a document that said she would be disconnected if the time came. So I don't see there's not. I'm not sure. I guess technically it would be like that. But it's a misconception. You're not going to be in a better place 5 minutes after you die. Probably.
But you have to go there anyway. Might as well get it over with. Might as well get it over with. You know? It's not like it's going to shorten that period, is it?
That's
a good point.
You're not shortening it.
That's a good point.
Suicide, it doubled it.
I don't know. I said before, I'm your friend. I have to tell you what I know. This is what I know. I studied for a long time. I haven't seen anything in the scriptures to contradict that. I've really worked hard. I've stayed up late many 20 years, and I can't see anything in the scriptures that says anything else. As far as morality, as I said before, it's not right or wrong. It's what? How do you define virtue in Buddhism?
It causes you pain.
Yeah, that which will cause you pleasure. And non-virtue is that which will cause you pain. And who decides that? No, but I mean, who decided what's going to cause pain and what's not going to cause pain?
Physics.
Yeah, but I mean, who? It is physics. In other words, a natural law. I can't change it. Nobody can change it. I can't even recognize it, which means I can't tell you what deed will lead to pleasure and what deed will lead to suffering. I don't have that ability. Nobody does. You have to take it on the Buddha's... it's kokyo. It's shinto kokyo. It's totally hidden to a normal human being. You cannot know. Therefore, you must study. That's all you can do. You can't. You can extend by extension. You can say, well, if it looks like it's bad to hurt people, I understand the rules now pretty clearly. And at the end of the Vinaya scriptures, it says, by the way, apply this to all the other cases. It gives you like 200 rules, and they says there's going to be thousands of other cases. Use your judgment. But I mean, on some of these calls, you have to. It's not good or bad. It's what will produce pleasure or pain for you, and we don't. We can't see that clearly. Only the Buddha can. We can't. You have to think of it like that. You have an omniscient being who's saying, "Look, if you do this, it's going to cause you pain. Take no work for you." And then we know from the other class why to take the person's word for it. We studied that the whole class.
Is there anything you can elaborate on as to how that natural law works or why it's natural law that causes you pain?
Yeah, some people have said, well, isn't that self-existent? that this should cause you pain. No, it's not. It's not that, are you saying it could never change? Could it never change so that when you did a harmful action to someone, you would get a good feeling back? No, it'll never change. Is it self-existent? No. And then we'll talk more about that. Is it just because something is always working that way, is it self-existent? Why? We're going to study in the 7th and 8th class. It's totally connected to perception and emptiness. You must, if you don't get that part, I don't think you can buy all this. You want to know how karma works. I thought it was so important that I called the course How Karma Works. We didn't get to that yet.
We speak in terms of absent body, speech, mind, and yet here with the first type here, somebody asked whether the feeling alone, the fierce emotion, was in effect a bad deed.
It is a bad deed. It is a bad karma. But what I meant was, normally this first one is explained as having great anger while you kill somebody. You see what I mean?
It's so normally it's two actions, really.
Is it two karma? Is it guess it is? Yeah. It's the sembele and the sambele. What's that? It's the motivating anger, and it's the deed which is motivated by it. It is two deeds. We covered that in the first last week. The anger that you have that causes you to move your body to kill the person is itself a karma. Well, we're going to get to that in the Friday night classes, actually. There, Tom asked some good questions about that. And I went and dug up some scriptures, and we're actually covering that on Friday nights if you want. Okay. If you'd like to have another 2 hours. But there's some, the monastic textbooks, they go into all the problems. They go into all the questions. And that's how you learn the normal stuff, is that you discuss the questions. You discuss the problem, you know, the things that are unclear. That's the method in the monastery. There are two things that will make a karma ripen in this life. You know, that would be interesting to know, right? Now I'm going to get in trouble again with some of you guys. But anyway. This is a different thing, okay? If someone wants to know, you know, what makes a karma so powerful that it's going to give a result before you die? You know, what will make the cooking take, what will make it microwave cooking, you know, of the karma? And there's two things that can do it, and they're called Shingikepa. The first one is called Shingikepa. You'll love the example in the reading. It's Galgen and Drupa, it's the first Dalai Lama. And he says, the Buddha himself took birth as a monk. The Buddha was a real bad boy in his former life, just like us, which is comforting. And he was a monk. He was living in a monastery. There was another monk. They were both very learned monks. They were both great scholars of the scriptures. And there was a falling out of the monks. The monks had a schism, yeah. So this other monk patched it up. He worked very hard. He talked to each person separately. He used reasoning, you know. He brought the whole karma back together. And the other monk got jealous. The Buddha got jealous, and he said, a woman has brought the women back together. And he meant it as an insult. Because at the time in India, a woman's place was, I mean, still, you can see in Dharamsala, you know, the guy walks ahead and the lady's not even allowed to walk with him. She walks behind. He yells at her like that, you know. And then they say because of that deed, the Shingikepa, Shing means object. The object towards whom he did the deed, which was that, it's really in essence the whole Sangha and that very good monk who brought the Sangha back together. Which is traditionally the work of the two greatest disciples of the Buddha. They're called the great bringers back together. Shingi Kempar. Kempar means, what do you call it? Distinction or something. Distinctive object. Very distinctive object. Kempar. So the object there was so powerful. It was a monk who had just managed to bring back all these. It's a great good deed to heal a schism of religious people. And then the other monk was jealous. So he collected a lot of ideas. He was born, he took a bad birth for 400 lives.
It says in the
beginning
that he turned into a woman in that life.
He did. That's a Tongyurki name.
In that very life.
Well, in India, in those days. You know, this is the thing that feminists call to say that Buddhism is down on women and things like that. They never quote the other part, which says, in the higher teachings, it's the opposite case. I cannot tell you about it. But in the higher teachings, in the secret teachings, the whole thing is turned around. So I think the men should write books about how Buddhism is sexist. But anyway, it's nothing to do with that. It's just that in the Abhidharma, in this system, it was not, and in India, it was not a great birth to take. You wouldn't have opportunities to study. You wouldn't be able to, you know, even in Tibet, I think the study of the women was not great. I think you're the first women really to go through the Geshe course in an organized way, I think, that I'm aware of. I know that they're trying to do it in Dharamsala, but I don't know how they do it.
Even the nuns?
Yeah, even the nuns. I mean, they had teachings. I mean, in the Vinaya, a monk has to come and teach them. But I think you're the first women really to get the real philosophical parts directly. I think that's good. Yeah.
How is this different than behaving towards a holy object? Same idea, but
same
less,
idea.
Less than a holy object or something?
The the things that make an object distinctive are discussed later in the reading. And they are your parents because they helped you so much, your lama because they can get you out of suffering, you know, things like that.
What is the essence of this? I'm not
the essence
getting...
of it is that if you want to know what makes a karma so powerful that it's going to give its result in this very life, it's the object towards which you're doing it. The first thing is, you can say a very important object. I give my money to the monastery because I know it's a shinche patien. I mean, that's not my motivation. I mean, if you have to decide where to give money, and there's a whole list, you know. Do you give money to feed dogs? Do you give money to feed poor people? Do you give money to feed monks? Do you give money to feed your root lama? You know, and each one of those is, that's a shin kempo-chen. That's a object which is very karmically powerful, potent, you know. Why? Because that lama can prevent poverty among a couple of trillion people if he works good. You know, causes of poverty are not knowing how to give. So it's just a very powerful, the object towards whom you do the deed is very powerful.
And do you basically determine if it's powerful by its ability to impact many others? Is that the thing? Mm-hmm. Definition?
Yeah, really. Yeah, the power to benefit many people. Rinpoche just dumps half his savings to Dalai Lama. But obviously he's made a decision there. He knows what's an important object. It doesn't mean that if you meet a poor person you shouldn't help them. You must help them. You must do all you can to help everybody. But these are going to be karmically much more powerful. Yeah.
In view of the fact that the society that where the Buddha lived was very limited in many ways, isn't it possible to interpret the sexual morality in the same light? That, I mean, we have those four ways of interpreting the Buddha's intent for the capacity of the listeners. So isn't it possible that when he made the very rigorous rule, it was to fit in with the Hindu society so that otherwise there wasn't anything else he said?
It's possible. I don't think it's likely. And I think you could study it. You know, you could go through those four rules of interpretation and see, was there a compelling need? And did he have to talk about it at all? And the Sangha talks about it, and then Jai Rinpoche talks about it, you know, 1400, 1900 years later. You know, personally, I don't think so. It's possible. If you say, is it possible? I say, it's possible. It's possible. I don't think so. I've heard people say that they think that. I don't think so. I think you could make a case for it just being harmful to you. But that's my opinion. You know, as a person who's read a lot and studied a lot and been around a lot of geshes and talking, I think that the additional desire required to want to do those things is what harms a man. And that's all. That's the main. I think that would be the main argument. We're going to get to that at the end of tonight, actually. Yeah. Well, there's like a Dzele Chumagiri. I mean, if you want to know the whole list, it's a long list. But you could say temples, holy, you know, places of a Dharma center is Dzele Chumagiri means there's certain virtues you get from physical stuff, which is rare. You know, normally it's a person. But any good done to, you know, to fix a stupa or to spend money on a temple, or that's all, you know, Dzele Chumagiri. That place is so important for the well-being, for the ultimate well-being of people, not the temporary well-being. That it's a very important place. So anything you do for that place is very karmically very powerful. Lama, and we're going to get into another list tonight. You get more lists than you want from the other Dharma.
So what do you say, Michael, that if you spend a lot of money for a temple to make it beautiful, that's good?
Not beautiful, but functional, right? I mean...
Yeah, but if you look at the... I'm sorry, I don't mean to disrespect the Dalai Lama's potala, but it's not... It's more than comfortable. And how do you...
That I don't know.
You see what I mean?
It could be seen.
I don't know. The Dalai Lama, you have to get into his motivation to do it. And he was an incredible man. If you read his book... He sat in the Potala and he said, I own two things in the Potala. I own the Dorji and my bell. And the rest is I don't know who. You know, I don't need it. It's not mine. I don't have any claim to it. All I want to own is these two things.
So, for example, a powerful object, an organization which feeds the homeless.
That's a good object.
That would be a
pretty good object. It's not in the realm of getting out of suffering.
Why?
It's the realm of helping suffering people who will suffer more. I mean, there's no
ultimate solution.
Yeah, there's no. But it's a great thing. I mean, you have to do those things. I don't trust people who say, "Oh, I'm working on ultimate good. I don't have to do any good things today." You know, for normal people, it's suspicious.
No, I was just to say, as an example, the scriptural example that you brought up, I mean, that's not necessarily physical, but the bringing together of the Sangha after a split, that's a virtuous sort of act of truth.
It's a big truth, it's a big virtue.
Right, but it's not a physical temple, or it's not a Buddha, or
something. Oh, no, they asked me other examples of big, other examples, and there's a special category of physical places. Mm-hmm. That's not as virtuous as helping spread the teachings. But it's related to that. So she asked me for other examples. Those are other examples. We're going to get a list.
And the last class we talked about when you do something, a good deed, it needs to be done with the right reason, with that idea of selflessness.
Right.
Is that intellectually or?
No self nature or selflessness. Do you mean
with that idea of emptiness,
I like that. Call it no self nature, so people don't think it means for non-selfish reasons.
So, is it that intellectual understanding of emptiness, or it must be having perceived it
intellectual at our level? If you are who you think to be, I don't know who you are. Okay, but at our level, definitely intellectual. You start with the intellectual level.
And so even if you have to force it.
By definition you have to force it because you're not used to thinking that way. And that's been helping me a lot. You know, I was on the bus and I was getting pissed off at the driver. And I said, no, if you get angry, you're just going to get more buses like this, you know. Just cool it, you know. And then that's wisdom. That's why wisdom is such a big deal in Buddhism. Wisdom means intelligence that's going to overcome your natural instinct. It's a big war between what you know and what you learn and then what you want to do. That's a big war. That's the classic war. That's the big war between what you've learned is right to do or beneficial to do or smart to do and then what you want to do. That's the big fight. It will be your whole life you'll be fighting that. Hopefully. Some people just give up. You know? Sampa, you know, you heard it before, Sampa, it means thought, the thought that you have. Kepa means extraordinary. And the example in the reading is, don't forget, why are we discussing this?
This one, this one.
Yeah, they can give you a result in this. They can make the karma so powerful that you'll see the result in this life. And again, I say, Tantra is based on that. You must know about that. It's not the Tantra and Abhidharma. Abhidharma is this little Hinayana thing, and Tantra is this big Mahayana thing. Ultimately, they're totally in sync with each other. You have to learn that. So the example in the scripture is of a person who is a eunuch of a king, and he saw 500, I forget what it is, cows, bulls being led to be castrated, and he had pity on them, and he it's very common in scriptures. He bought them and then released them. You know, he paid the guy not to do it. And as a result of that, his organ was restored in his life. That's the story. It's true. I hear a lot of. Did I have a tim about it in this class? I love that. That's great. That means you're a real Buddhist. Do I really know it? No. Can't say I do.
Oh my God! How did the fact that these bulls, whatever it was, it was not castrated, did not make a difference? I mean,
he didn't want them to go through the pain.
Oh, the pain. Okay.
He had this great feeling of empathy and compassion, and then that was so powerful that his own life the sex change. I mean, God is learning back. So that's an example. The two examples are parallel. And then the sex changes are all over ancient Buddhist scriptures, like in the monk's vows that, you know, what happens if you change your sex and things like that. It is common in the ancient times that people would, there would be things that would happen. It's all over the scriptures.
Of course, in those days, they'd be flying.
You love things, right?
Yeah. But it's not such an extraordinary thing. In scripture, it's mentioned a lot. You know, if you change your sex so many times in one life, then can you still be a monk? No, really.
Do they have sex changes then?
Obviously, they did, because they discussed it a lot.
But I mean, not in the way we think of today.
Not in Sweden.
I don't know. I think it was some sort of natural change. Coming. Okay, so those are the two things.
For
that
a
can
moment.
Make. I mean, the examples are hard, but you can take up your own example. I think as you get older, as you get to my age, you can see, if you study karma a lot, you can start to see some correlation between what you did as a young person and what you're getting now. You start to see some relations.
Could you give us another example, number two? Mark, was the story of education and my transit in example number two? Sent down to the maggots.
That's pretty much the whole hope that we have for getting out of suffering in this life through the seeker's teaching. Exactly that. The roots are there. That tells you how it works. But that's
cool. So what you're really talking about is bodhicitta, what you call spiritual.
Yeah. Well, no, it could be any. It could be negative too. You know, it could be an extraordinary fury, real case of fury. In this case.
So it's really the same thing.
But yeah, they're not contradictory. They don't contradict each other. That emotion, any strong emotion, would make it sure to give a future result. A really strong emotion, a really evil or a really pure emotion, would make it give its result in this life. No.
Which, by the way, is only discernible by an omniscient being, right? I mean, someone could have had a very strong emotion, something very unusual could have happened, and it may or may not have been for the act that they did in this life.
Well, can we perceive...
have to be omniscient to know that.
Can we perceive the laws of karma? Not in a direct way, but hopefully by the end of the course you'll have some intellectual understanding of a good psychological argument, perceptual argument, of why it should be true. And then you can use reasoning. You can use logic.
But is it still possible to do something very powerful, get a result that you thought was from that powerful deed?
And it's not from that deed. That's sure. That because we are limited.
And the only one who can know that for sure is an omniscient.
That's true.
But it does seem, I mean, and when you observe life, that you do see that happening with people you know or in people's lives. You see that they did something and you see a result.
Over and over throughout.
You see a result years later.
Yeah. If it was something, my father, I don't know, was it the result of that? He was a great hunter and fisherman his whole life. He grew up from the age, he took us out when we were 4 years old. By 12 we were shooting rifles. You know, and then later in his life he had to have these horrible surgeries where they cut him just like a fish, starting down here and working out. It's like, even in that time I was like, something's going on, you know. That's the way he used to cut the fish off. Mm-hmm. Do I know? No, but it's, yeah, you...
But you, I mean, I know, observing my mother, I can see, I mean, I could see, you know, how she treated people when she was young and she was healthy. And then later, when she got old and weak, these people got back at her.
Yeah. No. Seems like that.
And you could really, it certainly, you know, they certainly think, you know.
Yeah. I think
they certainly
look
that way.
You know yourself things that you've done powerful things. And then I think you start to see patterns as you get older. It takes some time. Changyarobe Dorje, in his tantric commentary, describes it very well. If you ever get to that point, you can talk about that. Okay. I'm going to give you four objects that are special.
So those are just those two. Those are the only two things then.
Yeah. Either the object or the thought. It's got to be powerful enough that you're going to see a result in this life. And then Fran asked for some special objects. Your reading, give them. I'll go over them with you. There's four that they mention in the reading. One is somebody who just came out of what the Abhidharma school calls cessation meditation. Cessation meditation. It's a meditation which is very close to nirvana. It resembles nirvana closely.
Is this the distinctive object?
Yeah. Now I'm discussing four distinctive objects. Giving you examples. These are the Abhidharma's own examples. A person who just came out of that deep meditation, where he was almost, it was very, very similar to nirvana. Now, anything you do to help or harm that person is an extraordinary karma that you will see the result in this life.
Sorry,
the experience is very close to nirvana. And according to the Abhidharma school, and that's a long story, what goes on in a cessation meditation is a long story. Yeah.
Right after they came out of it? Or
right after they came out
of their lives?
According to this section of the Abhidharma, the first few moments are crucial because they are new, they're fresh, and it's more potent than later on. So they are talking about, they explain why in the reading, they explain why the first few moments are more karmically powerful. Yeah. This is this old argument that you better not backtalk to anyone, they might be a bodhisattva.
So this is a distinctive object in this case?
Yeah. That's the first example given in the Abhidharma. The second example is called the immeasurable love. They have a temeshi in the Abhidharma. They have the four immeasurables in the Abhidharma. They are not the same as the Mahayana in the Abhidharma. They have the same name, they're a little bit different. And they don't define them the same. And that's a long story.
What's immeasurable love?
In Mahayana, it means the object you're measurable. You're having it towards all senses. That's the main meaning of immeasurable. Someone who just came out of that feeling, someone who just went through that meditation where he actually achieved that, and then you yell at him. Something like that. That's supposed to be potent, very potent. They also give the example, this is another example of number two, okay, it's not number three yet. And another example of number two is a person who's in that deep meditation which we call no mind, right? It's not that they have no mind, it's that their mind is almost shut down. Why are those two so powerful? Because those people are almost free of what? I mean, a person who's totally obsessed with love, and a person whose mind is almost shut down, cannot have mental function. These people are almost free. When they come out for a few while, you know, for 10 minutes or something, they are one of the few beings in the world who don't have anger, jealousy, hatred, desire, you know. At that moment, they don't have it. And then you do something good or bad to them, it's very powerful to you. Example number three. Someone who just came out of the path of seeing. Okay. Someone who has just seen selflessness directly, just came out of that meditation. And he can read your mind at that time. You know, for a while he can read your mind.
Michael, if you know someone who can read people's minds, then are they...
You should ask him to meet the lottery director.
Michael, did you say for the first time or any time someone is...
These are all right after they came out.
First time or...
They say newly, which normally means for the first time, yeah. Tonglam, you only go through the direct perception once in Tonglam.
You only go through the direct... I thought you go back and experience it directly.
Then you're already on Gomla.
Is this new for all three?
Yeah, so far. Yeah. Fresh out of... They're still like... They don't have anger and jealousy. They haven't asserted themselves again, you know. And for that person, he's gotten rid of those two main afflictions. Do you remember what they are? A person who has just seen emptiness directly, or selflessness, and has come out, now he's totally abandoned two kinds of bad thoughts. He could never have two things again. You remember?
Believe himself to
That's a different, little bit different. But he can never doubt Buddhism again. He will never doubt Buddhism again. He saw the Buddha directly.
And saw the erring truths.
He saw he. You can shoot him. You can beat him on the head. You can give him any argument in the world. He doesn't care. He knows what he saw. That's just. You can never have it again. So you can never have doubt about Buddhism. That's called tetsam. Tetsam, that kind of doubt about that Buddhism is correct and that it's true. You can't have it again. And that's a very nice feeling.
In this life or in any other subsequent life?
As a young child in a future life, he may not be asserted, but he doesn't have that active. As soon as he's old enough to think clearly, that will reassert itself. So it's a very comforting feeling, you know, that the thing is correct. Totally correct. And the scriptures are correct. Just do what they say and you'll be all right. That's just knowledge. So that's the first one. Second one is the intellectual belief in self-existence. You know, what you said, believing what he sees. He'll never believe it again. He knows that his perceptions are mistaken. And he'll never believe it again. They're talking for the first time. He's just a special. He's very special. He's a new steam enterer. Then the last example is the Jachamba, which is what? An arhat. The person who's just come out, he's just reached this level of an arhat.
What is
the arhat? A-R-H-A-T. And, obviously, he's special. He's gotten rid of his kleshas permanently. So anything, you know, do we know these people? Would we recognize them? I don't know. But those are the four examples in the Abhidhamma.
We're not going to run into them.
Excuse me?
We're not going to run into them.
You never know. You've got to be careful. You've got to be very careful.
Are you saying that if more powerful beings
that
these objects are more powerful than, say, arhat, who's been arhat for?
Yeah.
What's the theory behind this?
I don't know. I read the reading. It's not totally clear. I could look it up in some commentaries. I think the main thing is that they are fresh. Yeah, and it's just a new. It's a new member of this group, and it's like yelling at us.
We're violating.
You know, the latest person to win a special award. You know, it's just rather fresh. You know.
In a way, they're vulnerable.
It's not that they're vulnerable. I don't think it's that they are very special now. They're new members of an exclusive club, and I think it's just how special, you know, they've just reached a threshold after billions of lives, and countless lives. They've just reached this threshold for one once, and then they just become special. They're very special. Okay, have a break, and then we'll, we're actually going to change some time. How would we say that? I don't know.
There.
And I'll try to finish the break. At the end of your reading, there's a. I couldn't resist putting in. Kept me up till 3, I think. Lamrim Chemo, Tsongkhapa, on the karmic results, because it's fantastic. And I'm going to give you the 3 karmic results according to Jetson Kappa. Jetson Kappa has culled this from not just the Abhidhamma, but from his knowledge of scripture was unmatched since, and, you know. He was a master of everything, so he's written the commentaries on every major subject. So Namin, you know already. But I just want you to get a feel for it. It's 3 different karmic results. So we see that karmic result is not enough to translate these things. And I'll show you the differences, and you see. They're all karmic results. First on every major subject. So Namin, you know already. But I just want you to get a feel for it. It's 3 different karmic results. So we see that karmic result is not enough to translate these things. And I'll show you the differences, and you see. They're all karmic results. The first one is called namin. And that means a ripening. And then Jetsam Kapa goes through the ripenings for the 10 bad deeds. And he says, it depends on your motivation at the time. You know, how strong was your desire? How strong was your anger? How strong was your emotion? And how bad was the deed? He says, if you do a great killing, you know, a very serious killing, then there is the numin is a birth in the hell. So that gives you a feeling of what numin does. If you do a bad deed with like a medium level, medium emotion, medium object, medium kind of killing, the result is hungry ghosts.
What do you mean medium killing?
Medium means it wasn't totally premeditated with pure anger. It was partly premeditated with kind of angry, okay, like that. All of those factors were sort of medium strength. And then when you do a very light one, like involuntary manslaughter, whatever you want to call it, that would be the numbing would be an animal. So that's the numbing. But these are three kinds of karmic results.
And this applies to insects and any kind of bee?
Yeah. Oh, not as serious. An insect is not as serious as a human. I mean, to kill an insect is not as serious as a human.
But I thought it expanded in 7 days to be the equivalent of killing a human, for example.
You can say that. Well, it's a long story. But I basically have to think of the severity of between realms, you know. It depends on how close that person is to getting out of suffering. And bugs will never, in this life, understand enough to get out of suffering.
Are you saying that the numbing is one of the three kinds, or are you saying that the strong, medium, and light are...
Are all kinds of numbing. So a numbing from a very heavy bad deed is hell. A numbing from a medium bad deed is to be born as an insatiable spirit. And then the numbing of a lighter bad deed is to be born in an animal. And then Jetsam Kapa says, one sutra reverses the last two. But you don't have to worry about it.
Warning what?
That's the kind of person he was. He wants you to know that one sutra says a medium bad deed leads you to animal, and a light one leads you to an insatiable spirit. So that's the numin. The second one is called jutun. Jutun itself has two kinds.
What does it mean?
Jutun means the corresponding. Corresponding means there's a similarity between what you did and what you got back. And the clue to remember here is the word personal. Okay, and I'll get back to that. It's personal corresponding result. For some reason, it's very personal. I'm going to talk about it.
Between deed and its result.
Yeah. There's a corresponding quality. There's a similarity between that. What do you call that? There's another word for that.
Correspondence.
Mm-hmm. It's like a correspondence.
Concordance?
Yeah, concordance. Nyoma means experience. And it means you get some kind of similar experience to what you did. So in the case of killing, in your next life, the connection between numin and yutun is, it's always this phrase. Listen. If by chance you were born a human, finally, then you would have a jutun. One of these jutuns would happen to you. So what the normal numin is that you have to go down into one of the three lower realms. That's the numin. That's the ripening result. But if by good luck you got out of them, okay, if by some chance you got out of them finally, then you would have a jutun problem. That kind of karmic result would come to you. So what do you guess it is by killing? Your life is very short. Or you get sick easily, things like that. These are...
It's not a
result. Similar to killing, no? That your life is shortened. And you don't live very long. You're always sick. Things like that.
What are you calling this first one?
I'll call this the corresponding result of an
experience.
Personal experience, how's that? It has to do with your own life. From stealing, you never have enough things. You're always short. You're always broke. That's stealing. From sexual misconduct, people are always after your wife or your husband. You have trouble keeping your wife or your husband.
You mean from adultery?
Loyalty, yeah.
Not necessarily.
Well, they say it that way. General result is that your partner, there's a lot of competition for your partner, and sometimes you lose them. You have problems with your relationships.
Does Yongwa refer to the experience of killing or the short life?
The experience of having a short life.
It's
a resulting experience. And I really urge you to read Jetsun Kapa's The Ten That He Lists. He didn't make them up himself, they're from the sutras. And they're very interesting because now you can work backwards. I mean, it explains why some people are healthy and some people aren't, and why some people have good marriages and some people don't have good marriages. I mean, it explains practically everything about your personal life on the basis of those 10 non-virtues. If you have a problem with desire in this life, you know, my problem is desire more than anger. I'm not angry. I do have desire. And a lot of people are the opposite. So that's because in your last life you did 8 or 9. You coveted other people's things, or you wanted to hurt other people. To have that kind of personality is a karmic result. That's a nyongwan future. Your personality is determined by that karma. That's very interesting. Okay, the other one is chepa gyutin. Chepa gyutin means similar activities, similar actions. And what it refers to is that, you know, you meet people. I remember a kid when I was growing up, his big thrill was to take a BB gun and we would go out and he would look for nests and kill little birds in the nest. I mean, he had this love for it and this, in Tibetan they call it ying, he had this kind of pleasure about it, you know. And that's a chepa gyutin from having killed in his past life. In other words, it's the habit of doing that thing. It's the attraction to doing that bad deed.
Can be positive also?
Oh, no, all of these can be good, sure. You know, some people just by nature like to give away money or things, and that's a chepa gyutin of their past life.
So you're saying...
And there's no part of your personality which is not a gyutin. It's very interesting. You can identify all the parts of your personality.
So are you saying then from your past karma, you will have both similar experiences and similar habits?
Right, similar
karma.
Things... personally will happen to you, and also you will enjoy it. It also puts another kind of karmic result. It gives you that propensity towards that kind of activity. You're attracted by that kind of activity. You tend towards that activity. Gravitate is great. You gravitate towards that kind of activity. And the last one, I think that's your last one.
Number 3.
Yeah. Say it, Dagde.
Dagde.
Dagde. Dagde. Dagde means an environmental karmic result in your environment, in the place that you live, in the world that you live in. And they're very beautiful. Tsongkhapa, he takes them out of the sutras. You can read them. They're in the readings. No, the first half of the reading is very difficult, Abhidharma stuff. Skip to the second half. Jetsun Kapa had a gift, obviously. And he describes it very nice. He says, if you live in a world where there's a lot of wars going on, if you live in a world where there's a lot of chaos, a lot of violence going on in your world, it's because you personally kill things in your past life. So it's referring now to your environment. Your environment is dangerous. The muggers in New York are the fault of your harming. He even mentions muggers are the result of bad deed number 9. Yeah, most people who are sharing that perception together have killed people in the past or have missed them. They enjoyed seeing other people get trouble. And that's the karmic result. All the newspaper, you read the New York, that should have been the meditation actually. Read the New York Times tomorrow. Every single headline there, every single header is a result of your personal karma. For you. You know, if taxes went up, it's because you stole. You know, if a bridge is closed, it's because you spoke harsh words. And then there's a whole list like that. And they all make sense when you study the mind only, okay? When you get to that.
But wouldn't you have to say that there were other contributing causes like everybody else's karma?
No, if they have to experience that bridge, you know, if they have to get stuck in traffic because of that bridge
closing. Right. Yeah. All the other people got
absolutely
stuck in traffic.
Absolutely.
Contribute. I mean, they're.
Oh, would it have happened if one of them hadn't been there? It would still would have happened for the other people.
So, Michael, is that the way you experience it, or is this the way it is?
I mean, we're going to see later that there's no difference between those two. So that's, you know, I. It sounds wild, you know. You read the correspondences, you know. I think from sexual misconduct, you live in a world where there's a lot of stink of. If you go to India. You know, piss and poop smells and everywhere you go, you can't get away from it. You know, the whole country has got this problem. The reason why the rains, how come the rains fall okay in Thailand and then on the same latitude, a couple hundred miles over, everyone's starving all the time? You know, why do people in San Diego live in luxury and people in Tijuana are living in, you know, a couple miles away? Are living in filth, you know. What caused it? Where did it come from? And it's very interesting. If you get into it, then you realize what made New York the way it is, you know, and what made your, you know, why do I live on 39th and 9th, you know. And then when we get to the mind-only part, you'll understand why it's plausible. And that it's not just, you know, a lot of Western history books up until recently would say, oh, the Buddhists, they're trying to explain the world, so they made up this idea of karma to explain why the world is the way it is. And when you get into the psychology of it and the perceptual theory of it, you'll be able to accept it. And then every part of your world is a result like that. It also means that you could purify your world. And it's on the basis of that that you could attain paradise. Because this world is empty. We'll get into that. Because of emptiness, something nice can happen. But what's going to fill it in? What's going to paint in the empty canvas, it has to be what? Your good deeds. And, you know, people just don't want to hear that. You know, they just don't want to. They want to get to a level of understanding emptiness, and then they want all the morality scriptures to go away, you know. And it's not. We did Nagarjuna's letter 20 years ago. We sent it to a famous publisher. They actually wrote us back and said, could you cut out the morality part and submit the emptiness part? You know, and they go together. Why would the Buddha spend, you know, 60-70% of the scriptures discussing morality and good deeds if it wasn't something that related to the emptiness side? You know, that's the big thing. Okay, so have some...
This is the end of Class 4.